All these faculties we can acquire by three means: theory, imitation, and practice. By theory is meant a set of rules that provide a definite method and system of speaking. Imitation stimulates us to attain, in accordance with a studied method, the effectiveness of certain models in speaking. Practice is assiduous exercise and experience in speaking.
Hello, my name is Ryan Hamill, and this is New Humanists, the podcast of the Ancient Language Institute. I'm joined by Jonathan Roberts, my co-host and co-founder of the Ancient Language Institute. We are on a quest to discover what a renewed humanism looks like for the modern world. And today is a long time in coming. We are joined by a special guest, the God Emperor of Latin himself, Timothy Griffith. Latin professor, Latin fellow, what's your, besides God Emperor, what's your real title at NSA?
I normally go by, you know, Mr. Griffith, or okay. I am a senior fellow at New St. Andrews College.
Great. Well, thanks for joining us, Tim.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad to be here and talk about some of these things.
Yeah, it's hard to know where to start for the introduction. I think there's no way ALI would exist, at least in the way it does, without the work done by our guest today. So, Tim, you teach Latin at New St. Andrews, the college in Moscow, Idaho. He also developed Pictodicta, we'll call it a platform, but it's really many platforms, many tools for teaching Latin and Greek that we use extensively in our classes, both kids and adults, different levels, different modules, different tools that we use. Yeah, and just your approach to teaching has been very inspirational for us, because you're kind of taking, in my opinion, you're exemplifying what we read about for today's discussion about kind of the different pathways for learning and teaching. So thinking about the theory of language teaching, but then also paying really close attention to what's actually going on in the classroom, what's going on with your students, what they're responding to, how they're growing. And it's just pushed us as students and teachers and people leading an organization to constantly be reassessing, reevaluating. So yeah, I mean, technically today we're here to talk about Adherennium and Quintilian, two kind of really foundational, important pieces of ancient Roman writing on oratory and rhetoric. Really, it's kind of an excuse to have Tim on New Humanists. So that's the more extended short. Jonathan, what else should we say? What did I leave off that's important to say?
Well, let's see. So to give people a taste as to what a class looks, or the progression of Latin at New St. Andrews, maybe Tim, you can tell us a little bit about how students get started. So you take these, you know, raw, untamed, rugby-loving Pacific Northwesterners, right? Just totally normal kids. What do you do with them? And give us a sense as to what happens to these kids in 2 years.
Yeah, New St. Andrews. First of all, one of the biggest challenges of teaching Latin at New St. Andrews is that people are coming in from wildly different experiences. We have students that have come in with 12 years of Latin, and we've got people who've literally not ever heard a Latin word before they walked into the classroom. And on top of that, we've also got students who've had 12 years of Latin and yet can't produce or understand one word of Latin. And so they've got years of unsuccessful language learning that they need to move on from. And then we've got other students who have had really successful experiences. And so we've got people coming all over the place, from all over the place. And the only way we've learned how to deal with it is to treat it sort of like a sports program, where we sort of figure out different cohorts and try to get people with similar skill and ability and aptitude into the same room. And so we actually have 10 different groups for our freshmen. You know, we get about 100 new freshmen every year and break them up into 10 groups. And we try to predict it first where they're supposed to be. And of course, we get it wrong And some people just take off and end up going, advancing into more challenging groups. Other people end up going a little slower. But that's one major thing we do to start with. Now, I haven't really gotten to the pedagogy. That's just kind of getting people into the right room. But another major thing we do is we start from the beginning, the absolute beginning. We're explaining, this is what a noun is. This is what a case is. Even though most of our students have learned these things before, and either, you know, some of them learned it well, many of them did not. But the most important thing is that going back into it, we want to teach them from a different standpoint. We want to teach them where they're using composition, and they are using not just written composition, but oral composition or conversation. So they're learning to internalize these structures. And since none of them have done serious amount of composition, that's what I would describe this first year at New St. Andrews. It's a composition class. And so in the actual course, we're actually going to use some of the methods we're going to talk about coming from the Ad Herennium here. But theory, imitation, and practice do very much describe how we approach it. And maybe, I don't know if you want me to explain right now how they apply, or if that gets past introduction. You tell me.
One thing we can do is we can talk about, okay, what is theory in the work of these authors?
Yeah, we should do that. Before we do that, what's the like overhead view for these students? So they come in and you're forcing them to say stuff in Latin. It's like, oh my gosh, what's happening? And then what? Like, what do they read? What are they able to do by the end? Because they come out the other side and we hire them. We have a bunch of our teachers or people in or just graduated from your program. So how do they get from nothing to being hired by ALI? What in the world is going on?
Sure. Yeah. So, well, we really focus on composition in class. They do a lot of reading. They read through all of Familia Romana, Horberg's text in the first year. But most of what we're doing is composition. And the point of that is we're trying to create structures in their mind, vehicles for communicating thought. And these are the same vehicles that they're going to see in original authors in their second year. And they're also the ones that they're going to be using to communicate themselves. You know, in modern pedagogy of ancient languages, it's become custom to only teach a passive understanding of the text, because ultimately you're trying to read texts. And so people have kind of cast composition and an active construction of the language aside as unnecessary. But in reality, using the language in order to communicate through composition or conversation, what that does is it creates meaningful ways to express in students' minds. And so what happens is they know how to think in a particular structure. And what that does is when they see an author who uses that construction, it does two things. One, it impresses them because this is what they learned how to do themselves. And now they hear someone who's been dead for 2,000 years using that same structure. And it creates this affinity between the modern mind and the ancient mind, which is very helpful when you're trying to connect to a text. Simultaneously, they see how an ancient author uses these, how a phenomenal author uses these structures to their greatest effect. So something that they've tried to do, they'll now see Virgil do it. But when Virgil does it, wow, it's a really amazing. And so they know enough because they've tried to do it. I mean, think of it like this. So if you watch NASCAR, and you just see a bunch of cars going around in a circle on a track, that wouldn't necessarily be very impressive unless you knew what it was like to go really, really, really fast in a car. If you've driven the car, you have an understanding of what it's like to be there. And so you see what they're doing, traveling at those speeds, making those maneuvers the way they do, and it suddenly becomes impressive. But from the outside, if you've never driven a car, all you see is these things going around in a circle. I mean, it's not a perfect analogy, but the point is, this is all to prepare them. If you want to have people be able to read a text, they need to be able to read and communicate in the structures that that text employs. And so that's what we do for a year, is really focus on familiarizing students with these structures. And we have a lot of fun doing it. They're allowed, they're given certain vocab, certain constructions, and they're told, go for it. Now communicate something. They could say what they want to say. And we have myself and usually one other instructor that are walking around the room, and we're saying, yeah, you can't do that. This is what we would need to do in order to do that. So we're going to make corrections. Oftentimes we're like, oh man, that's amazing, or funny you should say that. Cicero actually uses that same phrase over here. And I mean, this is what we spend the majority of our time doing, going through their composing, trying to get inside of that vehicle of the language, give it a spin, see how it's going. And then we're looking over their shoulder. We're giving them tips, advice, corrections. And over the process of the year, they really get a feel for how the language works, to the point that in the second year, when they're able to read Virgil and Ovid and Apuleius, even though those things are still very, very difficult for a second year student, they find them moving because the language structure makes sense. So when they do understand what it means, it's funny or horrifying, sad, or whatever the author is communicating. And that's one of the telltale signs that someone's reading it for real. If you're able to be moved by the text as the text is actually attempting to move you, then you're really communing with the author in a way that you would not be if, say, you are looking at a text, following some sort of rubric and transferring that into some English and say, I think this is what it means. But you're not like, I can't believe this. I want to take these words and turn them into a tattoo. And, you know, they're such great words to live by. You just don't get that unless people are moved by the language.
Awesome.
It's actually great because I am one of the NASCAR uninitiated, but just kind of imagining myself driving, I would die. That's the first thing that comes to mind. But the 45 seconds before death would be absolutely horrifying. So I think it's a great analogy.
So a few weeks ago, we discussed a essay by Michel de Montaigne about education and talked a little bit about his own upbringing that Montaigne talks about in the final essay in his book of essays, which talks about the sanitary cordon of his father's castle, where everyone had to speak Latin in the castle as he was growing up, all the servants, parents. And so I know, Tim, you've done something similar. I alluded to there's not exactly the same, but similar stuff that some people have done. And so it's possible to raise someone in the 21st century, just as it was in the 16th, 17th, whenever Michel de Montaigne was alive, as a more or less native speaker of Latin. I think people would be interested to hear a little bit about that.
Sure. Yeah. So when I had my first child, my son, I started speaking Latin exclusively to him from birth. Actually, before birth, you know, you got to talk to him before birth anyway. Wife thought it was a little weird, but it seemed to work. But I had read, I did a little bit of research on how to be successful with a bilingual education for your kids. And I can't even remember the authors that I read, but it was in reference to learning English and German simultaneously. And one of the things that they said was, in order to be successful, you need to make a clear distinction between when the two languages are being taught, which makes a lot of sense. And the two methods that they had found successful were using a language in certain scenarios. So you could say, oh, at home we only use Spanish, but when we go outside we use English. Or the other one being you have one parent use one language and the other parent the other language. And so we did the latter. I spoke Latin exclusively to my kids for 10 years. And then my wife spoke English. Even when we were at the table, I was speaking Latin and she was speaking English. And I was really faithful with it. And it was very successful. As my oldest two kids, they really got the most of it because there were fewer of them. And so they had more time with me. You know, we were able to do things where, you know, when I first read the Harry Potter books to them, I read them in Latin.
Because the first two have been translated, right?
That's right. And so I used the first two, and they had to pass a quiz on the details of those from only having heard it in Latin before they were allowed to read it in English.
Was the quiz, I imagine the quiz was conducted in Latin.
Yeah, it was in Latin. I mean, I was really quite strict about it, so it makes sense that it was in Latin. So, but one of the things that really impressed me the most is, you know, even at that point, I'm thinking, is this really working? If I've been speaking him all these years and all this, as I'm telling this story, is he actually understanding everything I said? And I remember looking down and he was drawing while I was reading chapter one, and he was drawing this ridiculously accurate picture of Hagrid on his motorcycle. And I was like, okay,
heck yeah.
This is us.
Heck yeah.
Yeah. It was, that was pretty cool. So yeah, my oldest two, we went through that and I actually translated the third, fourth, and half of the fifth into Latin as I went. I didn't write it down. I just did it on the fly. That's how they got it. They really love those stories. But one of the funny results of that, awkward results of that, was they didn't really know how you pronounced a lot of the names. And so, you know, they thought it was Hermione.
Did you just kind of like give Latin endings and vowel sounds to names? Or did you ever calc the names when the name was like clearly meaningful, like Hogwarts? This is a compound of two English words, or like Voldemort.
Yeah, no, I did a combination. So I followed Peter Needham's practice because I started with those books.
Oh, right. First. So someone's already went first. Yeah, yeah.
So he did a lot of that. And there were times where I just would just go ahead and add endings. Lots of times when I did that, but I know that I must have actually translated some entire names too. I just don't remember when.
Yeah, it'd be fun.
Some of those, it was just the pronunciation.
Right.
So you can't say Snape, you know, you got to say Snape or whatever and deal with it as a Greek word, which is right. What I would do. But anyway, yeah, they absolutely love those books. Then going back and reading them in English, they're always saying, oh, hilarious. I can't believe you called so-and-so this name. But they understood it really well in a whole lot of detail. You know, that was one great thing. So we also would play some video games and we would only do it in Latin. And that was one of the places where my kids would speak in Latin a lot more. That was one of the ways I got them to talk more, was because I would do what they wanted unless they told me in Latin. And if you were playing the right kind of game, you know, then they know all the vocab. It's all this ancient vocab and it was really great. And so, yeah, that's...
Yeah, I remember the first time you told me about this video game experience that you gave your kids. We were talking about Rouse. And in his Latin on the Direct Method, he has this little statement where he says that images are absolutely essential for teaching Latin. because there is nothing interesting to talk about in the classroom, or there's nothing inside of the classroom that's interesting to talk about. So you need images of dragons, swords, etc. And then you told me, oh, yeah, you know, this is why I played these video games.
Yeah, absolutely. I completely agree with his statement. The classroom, I would say that the classroom is the worst place, not just to learn Latin, but any language, because...
I thought you were going to say anything.
Well,
possibly.
I would say it's an even worse place to learn a spoken language, because at least with Latin and Greek, you have a book to talk about. You're learning a language primarily for its literature, not, you know, how am I going to order it at a restaurant? Well, you know, classroom was a terrible place to do that. And it takes a really talented, imaginative teacher to transform the classroom into all these different scenarios where you actually use the language in meaningful ways. But yeah, I agree with Rouse very much on that, that images matter. And that's really what we were doing with that. And it was a good success. That said, you know, I think a lot of people hear that I did that, or hear that my kids learn that way, and they think, okay, well, that's the kind of education I'm advocating. But I think that what's really important to understand is that there are some massive limitations to that. And I would say in most situations, this is not something that people should be aspiring to. And I would say that here's kind of what I came up with, or came away with. One, the amount of time that it takes to make this work is huge. So an hour a day isn't enough. 2 hours a day isn't enough. I would say 3 or 4 hours a day of contact makes a lot of sense. And if you're a dedicated Latinist, this is what you do. Well, that's a possibility. But if this isn't the thing you do, then that's unlikely. Another thing is that as I had more children, the connection was diluted. And so what happened was, so when I had one, I was able to spend that 3 or 4 hours of time with one child. And then you have two, well, it divides. And then you have three, and it divides. If you're a minority language teacher, which is what you probably should be, let's be honest, you don't really want your kid to be a primary Latin speaker and secondary English. But what's going to happen is they're not usually going to be speaking Latin with each other. If you have two parents that are speaking Latin, yeah, then yeah, absolutely, that's going to happen. But if you
and
have
a chateau parent, full of Latin speaking servants.
Yeah,
that would help
there
too.
You go. Exactly. Right. And so if you're, and especially if the dad or, you know, is away at work all day and then kind of coming back, you've got less input time. So what happened is over time, as you end up having 2, 3, 4 kids, that I needed to spend more time in actually getting kids to understand, or getting the kids to get enough input, and then I had, and so there was a limitation that way. The other thing was, and it was great. You know, I taught my kids Latin. Well, my oldest two are, one of them has completed my college course at New St. Andrews, and has gone on to read the Aeneid. And many other works and all of that, read a whole lot of stuff. And so in talking with him, he's also gone through my college course. And one of the things that we've talked a lot about is he has this amazing store of particulars. So he knows vocabulary words. He'll be reading along Virgil and run into a word. And he's like, wow, I know that word. How in the world? Oh, yeah. I remember using that word in that video game once, or whatever, some funny scenario. So he has this huge store of vocabulary that is permanent. However, the grammar was something where he struggled with a whole lot of it before he actually took a composition course at New St. Andrews, where we really, really focused on how things are structured. And because of that grammar course, he has both sides of the coin. He can now understand, all right, I can argue why this form, this word applies to this word over here and not this one over here, that it's referring to this and not that. But I also have this natural sense.
Sorry to interrupt. Are you telling me that someone can get literally thousands of hours of Latin input from birth and still benefit from being taught grammar explicitly to them? Because if you're saying that, then you might face trial from the Comprehensible Input Inquisition, Tim.
Well, first of all, let me just go ahead and ask my son, who's right here, and so let me rephrase the question, because I don't think he can hear what you're saying.
Yeah, go for it.
But Will, the question is, after thousands and thousands of hours of comprehensible input, speaking in Latin, understanding it, hearing nearly 5 books of Harry Potter in in Latin more than once, after all that experience, did you need the composition class at New St. Andrews?
In order to understand things? Absolutely. Yeah.
I don't know if the mic picked it up very well. I mean, I could hear that he said absolutely yes.
So now all of that experience was amazing for him and for me. But that said, he needed a lot more. He needed a specific study of grammar in order to make sense of it. And there were certain points where this really came out. So for example, Latin has some places that are hard to just pick up. One of them is the difference between the deponent imperative and the active infinitive. So present active infinitive. So they both have this ending ere. And I remember specifically where, so loquere sounds like an infinitive, but loqui to a little kid sounds like an imperative. It's like deponents are the reverse. And that was an arbitrary difference, at least it appeared to him to be an arbitrary difference, was a real struggling point. Cases, he got cases right sometimes, and sometimes he didn't. Now, the comprehensible input people would rightly say, well, if you had more input, he wouldn't have needed that.
But you can't possibly imagine getting more input in the modern world. I mean, yeah, in ancient Rome, sure. But like, let's bring your theory to Earth here. We're in the 21st century in America. Is anyone going to get more input than that? No, no one is.
Right. I think that's exactly the way I feel about it. You know, people like to use the word comprehensible input. Well, the old term for it was total immersion. But what makes immersion immersion and not sprinkling is volume. You have to be surrounded by it. And so if you have a school where every teacher is fluent in the language and you're using that language for 3-4 hours a day, you can really make a lot of progress in a language that's not inflected, that's more word order based, like Spanish or another modern language. I think you could have a really good bilingual school going with that language. With Latin, you have way more structure, and word order is objectively easier than different inflections and endings. Why? Because word order, once you learn word order, it's the same for everything, no matter how it ends. So you can apply a word order every time, but with the endings of words, well, we've got 5 declensions. No, we've got 4 conjugations, but virtually 5. And then we have exceptions. And then we also have a whole lot of specific cases that communicate what we communicate by vocabulary, which is easier. And so, you know, the comprehensible input, total immersion, is naturally going to need less time teaching a language that's word order based and vocabulary based. It's going to need more time when you're dealing with inflected languages where words can truly be all over the place. Now, do I know people who succeeded in getting their kids to the point where they could do all this stuff without grammar? I think so. I don't think I ever asked them, did you never talk about grammar? But I think they did. Usually when they have two parents involved, you could get to the point where you could do that. But again, in this world, this isn't a practical method for doing this. And unless you're advocating that we just have monasteries where, hey, you decided that you want a kid to be a Latinist, so you go send him off to the monastery and he could stay there for a long time, that'd be good. Now, the last thing you're going to get from me, though, is that it's a bad experience. Total immersion is a bad experience. I think that it as a mixture with what they're doing in the classroom, it's really powerful. So when you do like a Latin conventiculum and you go and you only speak Latin for 12 hours a day, there's something that happens there that just can't happen normally. What happens is it's almost like the language overwhelms your immune system. And it's like your brain accepts it as this is a real way of communicating. And whenever we see this, whenever I've had students go to kind of a Latin, all Latin experience, they make huge gains. But I would argue that that isn't at odds at all with their grammar experience. It's complementary to, and I would say that if all you've had is a grammar composition experience, you need that conventiculum experience where it's total immersion in order to really grow. But vice versa, like it was for my son and now my daughter, who's now in my class right now, they needed a grammar class, you know, because in the end of the day, 3 or 4 hours of input from me was not enough for them. And I'm sure there's some, you know, language prodigies out there who could actually do that. But in general, I think it's not enough.
Well, no, that's awesome. Thanks for sharing all that. All of this, I think, not directly the reading, but I think very relevant, because the argument you want to make, we were talking before we started recording, is in these discussions of rhetoric, we learn things that are relevant for teaching and teaching languages, especially learning languages. And so, yeah, I think it's a interesting argument. And then the passages are very interesting. So why don't we look at Ad Herennium? Can you give us the 30 seconds? What is this text, Ad Herennium?
So Ad Herennium may or may not have been written by Cicero himself. Probably not. There's a couple theories out there. But it's a single volume that articulates Ciceronian theory of rhetoric. Why am I paying attention to a rhetoric text when I'm talking about pedagogy at large? It's a great question. In my own experience, I don't come at teaching from a modern language acquisition study, social study sort of direction, or looking at a book somewhere that says this is how you do it. I try to follow the most successful teachers and look at the principles that they've articulated, try them in the classroom, and then verify them. So it's like a good smith looks at what other good smiths do, and he tries to do what they do, and he kind of discovers his own thing. So I look at a history of artists, of people who, the art of teaching, teaching artists, listen to what they say, try what they do, and then kind of establish what I think. Well, the first thing that I found was this statement that I read at the beginning of this. This was kind of the beginning of me looking at what does good teaching do. So at New St. Andrews, I read this book as part of my first year course and in English. And I didn't have any experience in teaching and didn't know I wanted to be a teacher, but I had done a fair bit of coaching. I had coached soccer, which was my sport. And I think I was doing it at the time, actually. And I remember reading this theory, imitation, and practice and saying, no, wait, these aren't just the ways to understand rhetoric. These are the same things you use to teach soccer. And so what do I mean by that? Theory is where we explain, and he defines it there. It's a certa via. It's a sure road to getting there. That's when you start explaining steps. There are three steps to kicking a soccer ball so that it doesn't go 45 feet high. Okay. Step one, as you approach, you need to put the left foot, okay, beside the ball, not way behind it. Two, you need to make sure that your knee, okay, is above the ball before you start extending. So those sorts of rules, that's theory. Okay. And we do it. Soccer coaches teach that just as much as a rhetoric teacher. However, there are all of these other lessons that are too intangible or complicated, and you just can't explain them. And you almost always know you're doing one of these when you start talking and the audience just kind of their eyes glaze over and they're like, I don't really know what you mean. Okay. And then they'll say, would you just show me? And one of the things that's a great place to see these two different methods is when you get someone who wants to introduce a new board game to a group of people.
Oh, no. Horrible experience. Universally horrible experience.
Universally, yeah. So what happens is there's always one person who's stuck on theory and starts articulating, okay, here's the step-by-step approach to this. And then everybody else goes, listens to it for like 30 seconds, and then they're like, let's just play around.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Let's just do it, and it won't count this time. We'll just do it, right. It won't count.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Right?
We didn't know we were going to get great life advice. Don't explain the rules of a board game by reading the rules. Just like start playing, and it's like, no, that's not how you do it. You do it this way. This is what you do next. Let's just do it. And it's far more concrete, way more fun, and Cicero is in favor of it. So there you go.
Yeah. Well, so in soccer, sometimes you just need to show people, hey, watch this. Okay. And then now you try to do what I just did and you try to do this. Anyway, that applies there too. And even though, like I said, Cicero is talking in terms of a rhetoric education, I think what's really going on there is they're talking about an education for young adults. I mean, that is the audience that they're dealing with. And when you're dealing with people at that age, you need to be dealing with both types. If you're dealing with very young kids, you only are dealing with imitation, okay? Because they can't handle the theory. They're not, if you're talking to a two-year-old and you say, well, it is fell, not falled, because, and you start offering all of these reasons, okay, of the morphology of English, then
because of the strong verbs in Anglo-Saxon. This isn't helpful.
Something like that. Right. Right. It's like, well, it's going to fall on toddler ears that aren't going to comprehend any of it. So, however, the older that people get, if you're teaching someone who's, if you're teaching someone who's 45 and you're just teaching them and you say, this is how you do this, they will very quickly go, why is that the case? Is this like this other thing? So I thought we already saw this pattern over here. And it seems like the older people get, the more philosophical that they get. I think that's been observed in many areas of life. But they tend to want to relate to the universals. And they want to see it systematized. Hey, I just want to see it all in a chart. I want to see it all laid out so I can wrap my mind around it. And the reality is that as people grow up, something that's almost entirely imitation, okay, they start to have this other pathway of theory that allows them to do this. So if you look at a successful pedagogy in these years, okay, it's going to be a mixture of both. And I think that is what theory, imitation, and practice. And again, I know it wasn't written for this general thing, but I think it's true of everything.
Can I ask a question? So the soccer analogy and analogy, that's kind of what we're talking about with Quintilian, but the soccer analogy works really well. So theory, it's like, yeah, you know, these are the rules for kicking the ball well. Imitation, okay, everybody watch, I'm going to kick it. Okay, now you guys kick it. Imitation. What's this third thing? Practice. Practice sounds like imitation. I'm just doing what you do, right? How are those things distinct? And how are they distinct kind of in the analogy, but then also distinct for you when you're teaching Latin?
Right. My understanding is that practice could be applied to either or both. So for example, in a math class, if I say, here are three easy steps to solving an algebra problem, I could still have practice. That just means now solve another one, go through those steps over and over and over and over and over again.
I see.
That's still practice. That's an iteration of one or the other or a mixture. If I say, watch this guy do it and you do it again. This is the sensei, you know, with the staff, okay, whacking you and saying again. That's what the practice is. And the issue is, that doesn't tell you what it is that you did. Did you reason deductively and say, this is my approach? All right, I know this, therefore, though, and this, and move from universals to particulars? Or did you start with particulars and try to match them with like particulars? Okay, that's imitation, but you could repeat either one of them. And I would argue that most teachers tend to prefer one of those methods, but all teachers could improve by using a mixture of the two, regardless of whether or not they prefer one of them. And we've all had the kind of teacher who wants to articulate the theory, and that could be helpful. And then we've all had the kind of, but we get annoyed because we're like, can I see an incarnation of this? Can I see some flesh, please? Okay, I just need to see this happen. And then we have the other kind of teacher on the other side of the spectrum who wants to do everything all day long, but you're like, the chaos, can you please tell me what's going on here? And they've embodied whatever it is that they're teaching to you, but you still can't articulate it because it hasn't been simplified for you and your mind has not been brought to the universals that are in the material, if that makes sense. And so, yeah.
So now that we have some, you know, general handles on theory, imitation, practice, and since we've spent a fair bit of time talking about your experience with your son talking in Latin, could you give us like a quick kind of evaluation, you know, looking back on that and using those three categories?
Yeah, absolutely. So it's not even actually just, you know, my kid's total immersion experience in Latin. This is really every kid's experience in learning English or whatever their first language is. You start off by learning by imitation, and oftentimes it's copy-paste. So I know that mom says this in this scenario, so when I'm in this scenario, I will use that too, even if I don't know what it means. And so it's just copy a bit of language, paste a bit of language, okay? But that's imitation, and theory isn't even on the table. Like, you can't reason with with toddlers. Okay, everyone knows that.
You don't negotiate with toddlers.
Right, you don't. Now, what happens is, though, once they get to grade school in a normal, you know, English-speaking experience, a kid gets to grade school and they start learning about grammar. So what's happened is they've gone from imitation only for years, and they've transferred to theory. And the theory, if it's done well, allows them to tame the garden. Okay, it's almost like they have all this material, all this growth and overgrowth of language. But grammar allows them to understand it and give it some order and say, okay, drink, drink, drunk. I know you all struggle whenever you get to that form, but this is what you actually should be saying. And so that kind of theory comes later. Now, the same thing happened with my kids. they learned Latin by immersion only, by invitation only. And then later on, they had a few bouts of theory from some tutors that I got them. And then eventually they got both theory and invitation in the college course. Now, what I would argue is because they learn so early, that's all you can do. That's the way it works. But if you're learning a second language, if you're learning as someone who's capable of theory, then you should not learn with half your brain tied behind your back. You actually need both sides. And it actually makes more sense to do imitation theory, practice of both, exactly how the pseudo-Cicero, author of the Ad Herennium, advocates. It's happening all at once because it's that age group.
Tell us then, why are we also looking at Quintilian and Book 1, Chapter 6? That's the other thing we took a look at. What's happening here, and what's the connection with pseudo-Cicero?
Yeah. So Quintilian isn't pseudo-Quintilian, so we know this is where it came from. And he advocates, similarly, speaking on how to attain rhetoric, he's talking about language acquisition. He's actually talking in Book 1, Chapter 6 about how do we attain a good command of the language. Now, in a rhetoric context, but still, we're really talking about language acquisition. And he mentions analogia and consuetudo. Analogia, where we get, of course, the word analogy, is talking about patterns between other words. And he explains it at length. But he's talking about declensions, which he names, and he's talking about conjugations and patterns. Oh, this is how a word turns into the accusative on a regular basis. This is how this word turns into the ablative. And so that's your analogia. And then he says the other side of things is consuetudo, which is the usual practice or the custom, not practice like in the like pseudo Cicero, but the regular usage of language. And what we would understand by that is idiom, the fact that this is the word we use to talk about this. This is what people do today. And so if you say, I chopped down a tree, okay, we all know that chopped down is the proper verb as opposed to hacked down, okay, which gives us a slightly different image. That would be unusual, right? Okay, chopped down just means, yeah, you did the action. Hacked down, okay, you chose a different expression than what's normal, so we think of you as doing a really bad job of it. Anyway, that is something that we pick up through just the way people talk. The reason I brought that passage up to look at is because these match up nicely on theory and imitation. So you acquire analogia by theory, you acquire consuetudo by imitation. And so in one, you're looking at the universals. Okay. These are the things that are the patterns that exist in the language overall. And then we've got particulars, idiomatic expressions. This subject goes well with this verb and so on. So I like to look at that as this is an example where we're specifically talking about language acquisition and we're not limiting it to either a study of analogia on its own or a study of consuetudo on its own, which I think is the primary. Those are the two ditches in language pedagogy today. People either want to go one direction or the other. One of the things, he says some nice, helpful things about it, but one of the things he says that's very helpful is that he says analogia does not fall out of the sky. I think he says de kylo de lapsa, okay? Which is a similar expression to what Ovid uses when he says, when you're trying to find a girl, don't, you know, she's not de kylo de lapsa. She's not just going to fall out of the sky. You got to work hard for it. But Quintilian says that analogia isn't going to fall out of the sky like this Platonic ideal that's just going to somehow fall on the stuff.
Yeah.
He says you have to learn it by example. And this, I think, is really helpful because so what he's doing is he's saying, we don't just have an abstracted rule. You're not the jerk who's trying to explain how to play a new board game, who's like, here, let me just read some abstracted rules for you. He's starting with example. And so what's happening is he shows you, see, it's incarnated. This is how it works. And then you follow up with, you see what we did there? Here's the analogy. Okay. And so at least that's how I'd interpret it. And this is a method that we use at in Pictodicta Materials. This is one that we use at New St. Andrews. So what's going to happen is if we introduce a grammatical concept, which we do all the time, we're going to give you an illustrated picture of what's going on there. And so say we're going to teach you a direct object. We're going to give you a subject, a direct object, and a verb, and a picture of it happening. And we're going to have you go through a bunch of examples where the mind of the audience goes, huh, it keeps on ending with M, and that's not the one doing it. That's the one that receives the action of the verb. And what's happening is then you have a discussion, which is the analogia. We call this accusative case. It ends in M, at least here, that's a pattern. That's analogia. And that's taught through example. And like Rouse was saying, like Jonathan mentioned, it's really hard to do without pictures. Because if you're just choosing examples from the classroom, then you are going to bore your students to death very quickly. There's only so many things you could talk about. I've seen some very talented teachers that have an amazing number of toys in the classroom.
That's how I learned French. I had an incredible teacher in middle school. And I mean, she had like a whole play kitchen. And so we would act stuff out all the time. And but even there, like, it's still fairly limited. But oh, there's the Centurion, Playmobil Centurion.
My son always climbs the chair and wants to play with the Cyclops.
Is he? He is a legit Cyclops. There you go. Yeah, nice. Excellent. Yeah, so the toys, that's a thing. But again, it's just hard to actually achieve. So like in the Pictodicta courses, Latin Grammar 3, I think, has like 3,000 illustrations. And the Latin Primer 1 and 2 have about 1,000 each. So how many examples do you have? And how difficult is it to display them to a class of 15 or 20 as opposed to a group of 3 or 4? So there's some practical considerations, but that's why I think Rouse was right just to say, let's just focus on projecting an image because it allows the whole class to consider an image. It allows you to, an example, to get outside of the classroom and consider all the wonderful things that are going to happen in literature. So we could talk about dragons and swords and all of the things that not only make it more interesting, but prepare them for literature.
Yeah, here at the end of the selection from Quintilian, he says, "Nor is it a law for speaking, but the mere result of observation, so that nothing but custom has been the origin of analogy." And this is kind of funny because at the beginning of the selection, he had said, okay, here's the four ways to learn how to speak and write correctly. Reason, antiquity, authority, and custom. And so reason is, he says, chiefly supported by analogy and then also etymology. Antiquity, this is just like, he's like, it's this kind of like magical glow from the past. You just kind of trust what they have to say. And then you, with authority, you can look at orators and historians and they'll just kind of do what they do and what they say, just kind of follow that. And then custom is, he says, the best guide. And he has a great line. He says, we must use phraseology like money, which has the public stamp. So, you know, what people do, idiom. But then, so he says, reason is chiefly supported by analogy, but analogy itself comes from custom. It's this kind of weird circular thing. I don't know. How am I reading it? Am I reading that right? What's going on?
Oh, you are. You're reading it very well. I think now he also says at the beginning that analogy acts as the judge.
Hmm.
I think he uses the word, I can't remember if he remembers use the verb or not, but he says it acts to essentially to judge. And so there is this circular relationship there. Now, so going back to the statement he ends with, that analogy is the result of observation. So this is talking about descriptive rather than prescriptive grammar. And so
this is kind of where I was going. Does Quintilian solve the descriptive prescriptive problem here?
Well, I think he actually articulates the paradox, which you just ran into, right? The problem is that that we derive what grammar is by what people do, and then use the grammar, the analogia, in order to judge what people do.
Right.
And now I think that's what it is. I think it's what it should be. Erasmus, and I don't remember his exact wording, but he basically says anything that's ever been said well by anyone, you should imitate them. You should feel fine to you can use anything that anyone has ever said well. And he also says that anything that's ever been said well is the best possible thing to use somewhere. And if you think about it, it's actually doing the same thing. He's saying, well, what forms the authoritative, like, what is it that makes grammar grammar? It's not some like Platonic symmetry where you're saying, oh, well, okay, there should be, say, three declensions because three is a great number. Or we should have symmetry between this declension and this declension. Right. Or anything like that. No, it's determined by what people actually do. And we can explain some of the patterns within what people do. That's the analogia part. And that is helpful in communicating and teaching others. But it ultimately is determined by what people do. So I don't know if that, I think that, at least in my mind, that answers the question. Grammar is not what ought to be. It didn't fall out of the sky. It arises from what the best users of the language do. But it is something that judges what we do, because insofar as what we produce is inferior to what the best authors do, it's worthy of criticism. And so, but from a teaching point of view, showing patterns and universals of what the best authors do and giving reasons is helpful for older students in acquiring the language more quickly.
That's really helpful way of like articulating the paradox, I think, of the descriptive prescriptive thing. And the Erasmus quotes, those are great. And it sounds like something similar to what Quintilian says here, that when he's discussing authority, the role of authority in determining correct usage, he says, even error is without dishonor in following illustrious guides. So it's like, yeah, you know, it allows for innovation in a language. You know, if Rihanna says something in a really nice way, maybe we can all just start speaking English more like Rihanna or whatever. Maybe not Rihanna.
Right. No, anytime somebody uses the language in a new novel way that really strikes everyone, it is effective at communicating its point and well, and then people are going to repeat it. And as they repeat it, it's going to get incorporated into the language. I mean, one more thing to think about is if you read that Quintilian passage, it's clear he's really talking about consuetudo is the way people use it today.
And for today, that's Imperial Rome, right?
Exactly. For Quintilian. Right? So he's in the first century AD. Now, the way we study Latin, it isn't consuetudo in the way that it's being used conversationally today. Consuetudo is really the whole of the Latin corpus. And so what he probably would have called auctoritas, or, well, anyway, the precedent of prior, of the great poets and all that. That's really the main, input that we've got, is that's how we do it. And that's important because we're actually looking at 1,000 years of Latin And that means you have to rely on analogia even more, because some of the examples that he gives where he'll say, oh, I think he uses the word al-docter or al-docter. Can't remember which one, but he's saying, well, this is what people say al-docter today. But at one point they said al-docter. Well, what's happening is he's talking about something that was a momentary a phenomenon in Latin speaking that they used to do that. But if you look at the whole of the language, they say al-docter a lot more often, I believe. So anyway, you end up looking at analogia in order to give your students the tools to be able to handle not just a particular dialect of Latin, but the entire language. I don't know if that makes sense, but that's why we've got to do that. If you only teach them, here's the idiom of the day, then what happens when they get transferred to a different author from 200 years later, where the idioms have changed and yet the analogia remains?
The al-docter, that's seven, right at the beginning of 17, which he calls an unpleasantly perverse attachment to exactness.
I agree with that too. An averse attachment to exactness.
As we're getting close to the end here, and since we've already kind of started a mini crusade against the comprehensible input fundamentalists, how about we do a little bit more of that? So you mentioned that in your practice of teaching, you much prefer to look at, you know, what did other successful teachers do and how can I imitate that? Right. So versus what does social science research say and what can I do with that? What are your thoughts on why you do that? What are the pitfalls of going the research way? And yeah, general reflections on that. Because today, just to put some context to that question, there's a lot of excitement around the research. It's like, oh, there's all this research and people do all sorts of things with it, especially, you know, comprehensible input, second language acquisition, research coming out. What say you?
Right. Well, I think of course, the weakness in any social science experiment is that there are so many different factors at play that it is difficult to really isolate one thing and make an effective experiment from it. So is a technique effective in the classroom? If you look at the people who do this particular technique, well, there's all these other things going on. It's just so difficult to be able to say that's all that's really going on in the classroom. And I'm not trying to say that there isn't value in the research, but I think that that is a weakness of the method, is that it's just very, very difficult to isolate what's really going on. I find it easier to simply go to examples that of teachers who are teaching in similar situations. And so Rouse is the one I like to look at. So he's in the 20th century. He's able to use technology. He is extremely good. He's committed. He's teaching the same group, age groups as what we're teaching. They're dealing with multiple subjects. It's not like they're just doing Latin. So in many ways, he's the most similar example. And you just look at, okay, what are the things that he's doing? There's a lot of great evidence of how much fruit came out of that program. But you can say, well, what is he doing? And then you just try them and see if they work in your own particular classroom. And it's just a different approach. And again, it's not the scientific approach, it's the artist approach. As a craftsman, you look at other craftsmen who do something you want to do, and you try to do what they're doing and see if it works, and you make adaptation necessarily. My concern with social science approach to it would be, okay, so we want to isolate comprehensible input. Well, comprehensible input is effective. Well, I believe very strongly that comprehensive input is amazingly effective. And I've got so much experience with that being effective. But are we really talking about comprehensible input as an effective structure, instructive exercise and experience? Or are we saying an exclusive diet of comprehensible input, where we say, let's not actually have any discussion of grammar? Like, let's not actually talk about analogia. Let's not talk about, or let's not use the English language at all. So my attitude would be, yeah, so comprehensible input experiences are really, really valuable and important. But I don't think they're the only thing that is important. I would say paired with some other things, like a discussion in English of what's going on grammatically, is really, really valuable. Now, whoever, you know, the problem with any science experiment is, how do you set that experiment up and how do you prove it? And what does the person who's running the experiment want to prove? So there's weakness there. And yeah, not to say that it's not a valuable contribution, but that's just not the way that I like to approach it. I would rather just say, who's been successful? Who's got something good? Let me try what they're doing. Is it bearing fruit in my own class? Well, I'm going to do more of it. Ask questions of why, look at other authors who've talked about why. And those methods are I like them better.
Yeah, you see, theory, imitation, and practice applies to the art of teaching.
Yeah, it is funny, but very much.
Because that's how we started with your discussion of being a coach. Mm-hmm. So teacher training for Latin teachers should be, you're going to coach soccer first.
I mean, that's certainly how it was for me. I mean, that was my first successful experience teaching, and it was very helpful for me. So, but yeah.
Well, if people want to learn more, obviously they should sign up for a class at ALI, and then you'll get to use Pictodicta stuff, particularly if you do Latin or Greek. If you are looking for a undergraduate or graduate program to go to, either for yourself or your child, then you could go study with Mr. Griffith himself. If you're looking for something to do at home with your kid or yourself, so Pictodicta, which we've mentioned, there's a curriculum you can buy, the elementary and then middle high school age stuff can just be bought, but from Roman Roads Press, I'll put a link, where you can just buy the curriculum and use it yourself. We also have, we've been developing, in partnership with Tim, some like self-study courses where you get that curriculum with some other tools that ALI faculty have built to go along with it. And so we have the elementary program out, and I'll put the links there. But if people are interested less on a, I want to have the experience right now, and more interested in reading about this, obviously go read Rhetorica Ad Herennium, go read the Institutio Oratoria of Quintilian that we discussed. But what are some other good reading they could do that maybe connects some of the ancient thought to modern language acquisition teaching stuff? Do you have any recommendations, Tim? Something that's been inspiring for you?
Yeah. So there's a lot of great stuff that is scattered about, and I've never taken the time to write an article where I actually track it down. And so a lot of it I need to track down again. But I would say, you've already mentioned the introduction to Erasmus's on the twofold abundance of words and things, the De Copia. That was very influential for me in how to teach composition, how to look at language, how to the whole descriptive prescriptive thing, and that's very helpful. We mentioned a couple, you know, this passage in Ad Herennium, some in Quintilian. Comenius is another author who really, really writes some amazing things, but he does it all over the place in weird introductions and, you know, just a short discussion here and there. And I can't even point you to exactly where those discussions are, but he discusses many of these things, and he's been influential on me. Rouse, there's an enormous amount of material, interviews, Introduction to the Initium is one of the famous books there. There's another book. There's a there was a language a Latin instructor in the 70s, Paul Dissler. His book, Teach the Latin, I Pray You. Hilarious title. Teach the Latin. Just teach Latin, I Pray You. I don't remember if he talks about the theory much, but his discussion of particular exercises, I think, is a helpful embodiment of some of these principles. Those are the things that come to my mind. I wish I could give you some more specific references, but the truth is I have not actually taken the time to track them all down again.
Well, it sounds like here's what the world needs is an edited anthology by Timothy Griffith of all from what we call it, humanist language teaching from the ancients to the moderns. And you just you source all this stuff and put it all together and do some intros and get footnotes to tell people what in the world they're talking about. I mean, that I would pay, that'd be worth its weight in gold.
That would be amazing. I would love to get a grad student to work on that, because it's really valuable work, I think, to do all that. And the truth of the matter is, I'm more interested in editing fresh material that is appropriate for the ages where we're teaching Latin. Until I finish that task of working to produce some more just really engaging readings at that level that that younger students will find inspiring to read and be able to enjoy as they're learning Latin, I doubt I'll be able to get anything to that. But there are so many grad students that need projects. That sounds like an awesome one.
I'm going to follow up with you so that our listeners don't have to hear me make a book deal live right now. But I'm going to follow up with you on this. We're going to make it happen. But on the note of creating new stuff, yeah, this is final thing, and then we can sign off. I've been teaching Latin in person at my daughter's school to late elementary, early middle school age kids. And I have an hour a week with them, just once a week for an hour. And we're doing Latin Primer 1. That's the entry level, young kids curriculum Tim has built. Some of them do some homework. Most of them, I don't know. I don't know how much they're doing. And it's just amazing. So we've been going for 13 weeks, doing one lesson a week. We're going to start reading Puer et Monstrum this week. And I mean, it's amazing. I play the little story videos that happen at the end. And it's these narrated little Latin stories. There's no translation into English or anything. And the kids are jumping out of their seats. They're acting it out as it happens. They have little whiteboards and they're writing little stories in Latin using the words that they've learned through the program. Totally novel sentences that they've never seen before. You know, I never taught them to write about students attacking their teacher. But they come up with those sentences on their own and draw little pictures. Yeah, it's really amazing. If you're at all interested, you guys should really go check it out. So I'll leave it there. Well, thanks again for coming on, Tim. Thank you all for listening. We will talk to you next time.